but newspress.com.
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of AHA Presents About Education. I'm Neil Kreisel and I'm your host every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 10, and on Saturdays at 4. We're brought to you by Montecito Bank and Trust, proudly serving our communities and their financial needs for over 40 years. Pierre LaFon Wendy Foster, offering fine clothes, good food, and vintage wines. CSU Channel Islands, no matter which other academic programs you choose, you will be at the center of your educational experience. And Sansum Clinic, whose multi-specialty team of medical professionals have been providing quality care to you and your family for 98 years. And we're here today with Aaron Cross, a supervising probation officer at the Santa Barbara County's Juvenile Services Division. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
So when we think of the probation department, we think of a way to penalize, I mean, at least the way I think of it, of a way to make sure that bad people aren't misbehaving. But the thing about the Santa Barbara County Juvenile Services Division is it seems like you're really proactive in trying to help these kids, not just worry about them. And so tell us a little bit about the philosophy of the department.
Well, I think it starts with just the role of the probation officer. When you open a textbook and you read what that role is, it's law enforcement and social worker, and we find a balance somewhere in between. At times we need to be more of one than the other, but you always are working from that balance. And then when you add to that, you're working with kids. You're working with children, 13 to 17, 18 years old, who come to our attention for so many different reasons. You can certainly say they came to us for this crime, but that's never that simple. There's always so much more to it. And that's our job to figure out what that is and to help rehabilitate them.
What's so interesting is that we've had many guests on that are focused on helping teens, and yet they all talk about the schools are the place to start. That is, the schools, the teachers are given an incredible amount of responsibility over and above teaching. So I imagine that part of your work involves getting involved with problems even before they start in the schools. Do schools call you and say, we've got a problem here? Or is it only the kids that are already in the system that you're dealing with?
For the most part, we're dealing with kids that are in the system, but we work collaboratively with the schools. So sometimes there's certainly a phone call that they're concerned about someone. Typically, though, we would have had maybe a prior involvement with that family. We aren't and really shouldn't be the go-to agency for anybody unless there's a law violation, because there are so many other agencies in town that are equipped to address those situations without bringing them into the justice system.
So when somebody comes into your office for the first time, that intake, that must be pretty nerve-wracking for the kid. And so how do you try to be a tough guy? You try to be a social worker? I mean, how do you deal with the sort of push-pull between helping them deal with whatever emotional problems they have that put them there in the first place and the idea that there's certain responsibilities you have to now adhere to?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we get a variety of kids in there. They're there for so many different reasons. And then add to that, we're working with the entire family. So the family's level of involvement, their responsiveness, their level of concern, things that they've already put into place before we've seen that child. They've already, you know, proactively worked with the school to get them involved in counseling at the school or something outside of the school, or they've reached out to the victim and tried to repair some damage done versus a family that's maybe enabling or maybe in need of services themselves. So there's so many factors that we consider when we're trying to work with the minor and the family that it's the approach is really centered around what is the biggest need.
So let me ask you a really unfair question right at the beginning of the show. Unfair in the sense that if you have been in the probation department for 80 or 90 years and you're really cynical and you don't think anyone can be saved, that's one approach. The other approach is that you really care about people and want to help. How do you make sure that there's a homogeneous product at the probation department, that you're not just looking at these kids as perpetrators, but you're trying to save them?
I think, first of all, we don't have any probation officers that are that old, so
I hope
that's helpful. I'll look into that, though, when I get back, but I think we're good for a while.
Look down if you're going to be looking for them.
Yeah. Woo. You know, people in the juvenile division really ask to be there. It's hard. I mean, especially if you have kids of your own or, you know, even nieces, nephews, just to see some of the trauma that these children have been through. And, I mean, there's a lot of pain and a lot of suffering, and then they act out. And sometimes they act out in really bad ways, and now they've harmed a victim. And so it takes a lot out of people to be in the juvenile division. We work with the entire family, so we're talking to the parents and whoever else is involved with this child. And the people there, at least the ones in my office, really want to be there. They want to work with children. Most of them didn't get into the field to be a probation officer so much as I want to work with children, and probation seems to be a good avenue to do it. So I think that that's really helpful. I've also found that there's a lot in the state and across the country, but specifically in the state, that's really changed in terms of, you know, research and education on the juvenile brain and development and everything else and trauma-informed care. And our officers have really absorbed that, and it hits home. It kind of explains things we kind of knew, but we didn't understand 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and now that light bulb's kind of going off. And so some of those people that were probably pretty frustrated before are kind of now seeing that light and that understanding of some of the explanations as to why we're seeing some of these things, and then that window into actually how to help.
Do you ever come across a kid that just is so injured he just can't or she can't be helped?
I'd like to think not, but we've run into kids that don't want it and they're not ready to take it for whatever reason. Trust is a big issue for some of these kids. I mean, and it kind of depends what you mean by that. If you have a kid with extreme mental health issues, we do have an obligation to the victim, to the community, to protect them. But sometimes we are not the best agency to be involved with that child because their needs are so great and this is what's affecting their behavior. But not everybody's ready for help at that moment. Not everybody's ready to see what those issues. Some stumble, have to get back up. It just, you know, we try to never give up. I mean, 18 years old is not really a give up kind of age on someone.
And does restorative justice take part in your plan? Because you're involved in what one would think is the traditional penalty phase. But is there a way of integrating restorative justice into what you do with these kids to show them what harm they've done and to make amends?
Absolutely. The schools are actually very good about doing restorative justice. They've been doing it for the last couple of years. So sometimes we're just kind of supporting that process depending on what the actual offense is. There is an actual restorative justice program at times we're referring to. Sometimes it's the spirit of it. A lot of times it's a family member who's injured and or hurt by what's happened. And so the restorative justice in some ways is created sometimes through that counseling and through those interventions for that genuine apology and genuine recognition of the harm done and giving that child the chance to make it up to that person.
One of the things AHA stresses is the need to build empathy for these kids, have them build a sense of empathy. And there are some kids that at 13, 14 just don't seem to have it. So I ask this question of anyone working with teens. If a child does not seem to be empathetic, is there a way to teach that child how to nurture their empathy?
I think one of the big things that we're doing is we have a new juvenile risk assessment tool, and what it tells us are what their critical needs are that need to be addressed, but it also tells us their protective factors. So we have the ability to kind of look at everything going on for this child, and sometimes the trauma is so great you can't get to that empathy piece right now. You have to help heal that child. I mean, we have situations where that child's been very badly abused throughout their life, and now they've committed a crime. And so it's been all about self-preservation. So you're not going to jump in and teach this child empathy. You have to help that child heal. I have come across very few children where I think, oh, there's absolutely no sense of empathy versus it's not something they're ready to address now, but most of them at least have some insight that they've caused harm, they can do better, they just don't necessarily have the tools to do it right now.
And listening to you speak, it is, which is great that you have these tools that I would not have thought is in the box of a probation officer. You really have to be somebody who cares. You have to be somebody that understands mental health issues. You have to be somebody that has compassion, which is not what you usually see in the police department. So is that something that you're just unique, or but remember, other people in the department will hear this program. But are you the only one, or is it sort of systemic that people who do this, in particularly those involved with young people, have that extra sense of care for these kids?
I think we're very fortunate in Santa Barbara County, especially South Santa Barbara County. This is a very tight-knit community that has a lot of resources. I go to so many meetings where there's so many partners in this community that want to help kids. They're constantly looking for ways to work together to really support them well beyond any probation involvement, preferably without any probation involvement. And I think we have so many different initiatives and things going on, just recognizing what the research is telling us, the direction the state is taking juvenile justice in general, to say these are still children. They're children who make mistakes. It comes to attention. And sometimes people get hurt. And you have to find that balance. But I absolutely think that it's really just the theme in working with kids that I find in the probation department, but in all the agencies we work with. I think pretty soon, if that's not what you're there for, you're almost going to get shamed out of it by other people, because all of that genuineness is there and so many people do want to help. And then you actually start working with these kids and you realize they're not that different than the, quote, regular kid. It's the same kid. They've just manifested some symptoms in a different way.
See, this is why I'm glad I moved to Santa Barbara from New York. We couldn't do this in New York, this kind of conversation.
Good thing they don't hear you in New York.
How do you know? They could hear it. My accent, my New York accent, goes so far.
It does?
Yeah, it automatically goes to New York. I think it's time to take a break. You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
In 1962, Pierre Lafond founded the first post-prohibition commercial winery in Santa Barbara County. In 1972, he planted his first vineyard in the San Ynez Valley west of Buellton, and later hired legendary winemaker Bruce McGuire to continue to build on the stellar reputation that Santa Barbara Winery has achieved for more than 50 years. Today, you're invited to experience the award-winning wines at Santa Barbara Winery at the corner of Yananali and Anacapa, and the Lafond Winery at 6855 Santa Rosa Road in Buellton.
With some health providers, you get the impression that the final goal is profit. But Sansum Clinic is a nonprofit. Their final goal is health.
Sansum Clinic was started by doctors and is still directed by doctors dedicated to offering the very best in healthcare and healing for our patients.
A nonprofit organization where all earnings go back into continually improving healthcare for our community.
Your health.
Your doctors.
Your healthcare system.
Sansum Clinic. Good for you.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a four-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a four-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. Programs and workshops in classroom, online, with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online at csuci.edu.
The Central Coast may seem laid back, but when it's time to work, no one works harder, including the bank that's grown up here. Montecito Bank and Trust offers customized lending and banking for all businesses, big and small. It's harder than offering one-size-fits-all solutions, but it's the right thing to do. And here, getting things right is a way of life. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA uses innovative social-emotional learning and character building to help teens. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with Aaron Cross, a supervising probation officer at the Santa Barbara County's Juvenile Services Division. So tell us about your background. How did you get involved?
It's actually quite a funny story. So I, like probably many people around my age at the time, really like shows like FBI type shows, and I wanted to be an FBI agent. And I was working at a gym of all things, and a woman came in regularly who was trying to get into the FBI. And as she's telling me her stories of trying to get in the FBI, I was still in grad school at the time. I wasn't really applying or anything. She started talking about the work she currently did for the probation department. And all of a sudden, that just seemed so much more interesting to me, and the opportunity to stay in Santa Barbara after college and through grad school. And so I applied to kind of our entry-level position to work in one of our facilities at our Los Prietos Boys Camp. And I was 21 years old, and I never left.
So it shows you about prejudice. You said you were finishing graduate school. I don't, when I think of a probation officer, I don't think of somebody starting out with already with a graduate degree. Are you more highly educated than everybody else, or that's the kind of standard there is now?
To be an actual probation officer for our department, you have to have a bachelor's degree, but many of us do have graduate degrees as well.
which is why you're able to do all these different diverse objectives, which is great. Are you ever scared?
Of the kids?
Yeah.
Not really. I mean, we go into some houses sometimes I'm not 100% comfortable in, but in my day-to-day work, no.
Okay, so but there are some kids who have committed violent crimes.
Yes, many that we've supervised have committed violent crimes.
When they're put into probation, are they more likely to be compliant in terms of at least overtly compliant to you?
Depends on the kid. It depends on kind of their situation in life, where they're at, what's going on at home, school, around them, in their community, in their neighborhood. I think sometimes it depends on the rapport they build with the probation officer, with who's ever providing services. If they have just even that one person that they're connected to in some kind of mentoring fashion, and they don't even want to, I feel when I worked at our boys camp, I remember the boys when they would make a mistake saying, "Are you mad at me?" And I would always say, "I'm not mad, I'm disappointed." And the look on their face, they would so much rather that we were mad at them and that disappointed. And I think sometimes when you've connected with that person and disappointed matters more than mad, then they don't want that disappointment. They'll work not to get it.
So you said that it you know, there's a whole network of people that interact with these kids. Gangs do too, and a lot of these kids don't have any support network other than the bad influence of gangs. How big a role does that play?
I think it depends on the kid. I think it depends on the family. We're fortunate in South Santa Barbara County. We don't have quite the gang issues that we do in northern Santa Barbara County, but obviously they do exist. There's a lot of opportunities for them to be otherwise involved. But, I mean, the saying it takes a village is really true. It takes, you know, the parents really making that a priority. And sometimes that's very hard when you have parents that have to work multiple jobs and strange hours at night and everything else. Sometimes it's siblings kind of stepping up and being that role model and that protector. Sometimes it's neighbors helping neighbors. Sometimes it's, you know, community organizations getting involved. And I think the more educated parents are to it and the earlier that they're able to have those conversations with their children and seek those interventions, the more successful they're going to be in protecting their kids. And some, of course, are going to just fall prey to it and unfortunately end up in the system, but most of them don't. Most of them get out.
So if you see someone that, in your view, is exhibiting some mental problems that go beyond the normal, you know, teen years, do you have a way of getting them to the right help, for the right help?
Yes, we're very fortunate that we have contracted with behavioral wellness. And if we have any concerns that a child has some undiagnosed mental health issues, we ask them to provide an evaluation for us. So they'll meet with the child, they'll meet with the family, they're going to get school records, child welfare records, they'll look into any prior mental health issues or records, and they're going to write a report for us that's going to outline what this child's needs are, perhaps what the family's needs are, and then recommend services and help us connect them to services.
Do you come from a law enforcement family?
No.
What did your parents say when you just told them you were going to do this?
I don't think they understood.
Because?
They just know, most people didn't know what a probation officer was that long ago, and they just thought, okay, or they thought maybe it was a stepping stone and it would just pass. I don't know.
So are they proud of you now?
I hope so.
No, because the resistance to accepting what you do and understanding what you do goes from person on the street all the way to your home.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that sometimes that's a challenge as well. Okay, so we have mental health problems that obviously affect behavior. What about drugs and alcohol and just normal teen partying? When somebody comes in to see you, do you restrict them? Do you say, look, you're in a position now, not like your friends. You can't go to parties. You can't get drunk. Are there rules that make them have to toe a line different from what they were able to do before?
Yes. So they would typically have rules that would say obey all laws. So that in itself would say don't use drugs, don't drink. Some have drug testing terms, no alcohol terms. It kind of depends on the offense. But by the nature of it, it's illegal for them to do anyway. It is an issue. We're fortunate down here that it's not. We're mostly seeing alcohol and marijuana-related offenses or involvement And then it's providing that education to them and that intervention to them. We're not going to put a child in juvenile hall with very serious offenders for one positive test for marijuana or something. So we're looking for alternatives for them to steer them in a better direction, but also to provide them the education of why we're doing that.
Oh, and if a kid has a drug problem, are there places you can send them so they don't get into trouble, so they can deal with their addiction, if it is an addiction?
Yes, there are some programs. A lot of it takes some parental involvement. We don't specifically have a, like the county doesn't provide a residential drug treatment program for juveniles. Mm-hmm. So there's some opportunities, but a lot of it is really the parents seeking that opportunity for their child as well. Because if you don't have that support and that level of importance and really enforcing it, we don't live in those homes, it's not going to be successful.
Has the legalization of pot been a problem? Is that exacerbated the issue with kids and pot, or it's...
They still can't just go buy it at the store. So it's still, I don't see as many referrals for it, but I don't think it's really changed a whole
and
lot
how
in
many,
the juvenile world.
How many people, how many files do you have to have as a probation officer? Do you have 10 or do you have 5,000? I mean, how?
Oh, it depends on the level of risk. So it could be anywhere from 50 would be our highest caseload, being our lowest risk kids, to 15.
Okay, so... Wow, so that's a good small number. I'm not saying it's not hard work, but you can really, if you have 15 kids, you can really focus on them.
That's our goal. Those are our 15 kids would typically be our kids with the most extensive mental health issues and the highest need kids. So those are ones that are going to probably have, on a positive note, a lot of involvement from other agencies, but that takes a lot of collaboration on our end to make sure everybody's communicating and we're clear on who's providing what services and what the participation level and supporting the parents in participating. And so there's a lot of collaboration involved in that. And really, I mean, honestly, having a conversation with one of those kids and their family members and everything else, that in itself takes more time than a low-risk kid who made the one-time mistake, doesn't have those mental health issues. An office visit with that kid's probably 15 minutes. The kid with the extreme mental health issues and all kinds of conflict and things going on in the home, that could be a two-hour office visit.
If anybody in law enforcement, I guess burnout is a problem. Do you ever get a kid coming back and saying, thank you so much, you saved my life? So to offset that depressing part of your job, do you get these kind of, oh my God, I'm glad I do this story?
So I love when my officers have somebody come back. I have one officer who has a couple notes that she puts up on her bulletin board, and I think she looks at them every day, and I often tell my officers that that's the goal, right? Not all of them are going to say thank you, but when you get that, hold on to that. When they stop you on the street and they say, hey, I'm doing well, hold on to that. I know I personally have a couple girls that I have kept in touch with, we don't even need to say how long, but probably close to 20 years at this point. And it's so nice to see them doing well and having their own families and really having grown through the system and passed it.
I would imagine without that, it would be a really frustrating job without having the reward of seeing, and which is what's nice about what you do. You actually can see, you're not making things in a factory. You're actually making something and saving people's lives, and those lives you can actually see on the street. You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station, and we'll be right back.
Celebrating 50 years of serving loyal regular guests and first-time visitors, the Pierre Lafond Market and Deli invites you to enjoy their huge selection of fresh-baked sweets, cookies, carrot cake, muffins, and the famous farm cake, granola, Oreo popcorn, wine cake, homemade soups, and the popular fresh juice bar. Or get a coffee drink or fresh-squeezed juice and peruse the famous wall of greeting cards at the Pierre Lafond Market and Deli. Open 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. daily in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
Sansom Clinic. We're there at the beginning.
And all the little and big steps along the way.
200 physicians for your every need.
A healthcare system where all profits go back into our community's health.
Your health.
Your doctors.
Your healthcare system. Your health.
Your doctors.
Your healthcare system.
Sansom Clinic. Good for you.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a four-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a four-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. CSU Channel Islands is affordable and financial aid is available with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online at csuci.edu.
What's that?
This? The newest online business banking around.
Can you initiate wires and approve transfers?
Yes.
Pay bills?
Check.
Cash management?
Of course.
All business, all online, all on your phone.
You bet. My computer, too. It's Montecito Bank and Trust's new business online banking. It works as hard as I do.
Huh. Montecito Bank and Trust.
You got it. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, Improving Attitude, Creating Social Harmony, Bridging the Achievement Gap for Teens. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with Aaron Cross, a supervising probation officer at the Santa Barbara County's Juvenile Services Division. So we're talking about not only just Santa Barbara, but Santa Barbara South. But there's stuff going on all over the country, all over the state. How do you keep up with, and do you keep up with, I'm sure you do, all the new things that are going on? What are some of those new things happening?
Well, I think most people know there's a lot of changes going on in the state. There's a lot of research into the juvenile brain itself, into the juvenile justice system, and there's been a lot of changes in the last couple of years in, you know, the minimum age for a juvenile, the age to actually have the possibility of being filed on as an adult, and the state has really changed a lot of that. And so obviously, we take our direction from that. We have a really awesome grant that we're involved in right now called Reinventing Juvenile Justice, and it's a collaborative effort. It's probation. We have public defender's office, district attorney's office, behavioral wellness, child welfare, public health, some community-based organizations involved, and we're all kind of working together to reimagine juvenile justice. And so we're looking at our processes and how we're all often involved with a case or a minor and a family at different times, and how we can share information and how we can either keep them from the juvenile justice system, or if they're in the juvenile justice system, how can we ensure they remain or are connected to these other agencies so that they don't need us for support, so they have everything that they need, the entire family, without that justice component. So it's kind of exciting to see everybody working together. I mean, you know, you start off by really just getting to know, what does everybody do? What is your job? And then you start talking and you just realize how many of these families overlap, and it's a different time in their life. It's a different need. Something else is bringing them to somebody else's attention, but it's really interesting how much they overlap and how many opportunities there are to keep them from our system, but still provide those supports.
A few years ago, I was on the Domestic Violence Solutions Board, and one of the things they taught us is incoming board members is not to think of the perpetrator in a stereotypical way. There are doctors and there are lawyers who are domestic violence perpetrators. What is there does it go across all socioeconomic categories, youth offenses, or is it basically what people seem to think, it's poor people? I mean, is it Who are these kids? Where do they come from?
Well, I mean, it's a diverse group. It's not one group that's coming to our attention. They come to us for so many different reasons. So the way that juvenile probation works in general is we get everything. And what I mean by that is, in the adult world, when a police officer writes a report, issues a citation, it goes to the district attorney's office to decide what's going to be taken any further. In juvenile probation, everything comes to us unless it's somehow diverted from law enforcement. Every other crime would come to us. And so we're making decisions on what are we going to do with these things. So we see literally everything from curfew and jaywalking to attempted murder and murder. We see everything. And so because of that, it crosses every socioeconomic group.
And where does it go? So you get the first look, and then you're the one that refers it to the DA?
Potentially. There's our code section mandates us to refer certain offenses. Some we are able to handle just on our own in our office without it being referred to court.
And we're one county, but it's quite a big difference in terms of everything about
yes.
North and South. Do you have meetings together with the North and the South and,
yes.
and discuss common problems? And are there common problems?
Absolutely. So each, you know, as a juvenile division, we meet at least once a month, although I think we see each other probably once a week. And we're constantly, you know, evaluating the new research that's come out, the new laws that have come down, you know, the new case law, the ruling that went, you know, came from the Supreme Court, whatever it is, we're constantly talking about those things. We're constantly talking and evaluating what services do we have, what's working, what's not working, what barriers are there for these families. Because while there are definitely differences across this county, as I'm sure there are in any county, there's a lot of commonalities too. Sometimes there's things that are just inherently different. The school districts are very different across this county. And because of that, I think some of the services available are different. So there's certain things like that that they're pretty static. We can't do anything about that. But there's a lot of common things, and it's just having those conversations and seeing, okay, so what are you guys doing? What are you guys seeing? What are you guys doing? And it happens quite a bit.
California passed a piece of legislation a couple of years ago, which was really amazing, because you'd think you shouldn't have needed to pass it, which where a kid got 13 years old, murdered somebody, and got a life imprisonment. And you know, there are people, kids 12, 13 years old that did a heinous crime, and they're getting life imprisonment without parole. And California just got rid of that possibility, which maybe is emblematic of what you're doing, that is, nobody is, you can help everybody if you give it a chance. You know, throwing the key away on a 13-year-old seems awfully harsh. Are there national conferences? Are there things that, you know, if you look at a shopping mall in any city, they all look the same, because developers go to every city and take the best. Are there national programs where you can go to a place and hear everybody's story and how the nuances and how they made things work for them?
There's conferences. There's certainly programs. And I think what I've found in my experience is that it's rare that you can go to another state, a completely different community, and pick up their program and reinvent it in yours. The community dynamics, the community involvement, the types of crimes you're seeing, the geography of that community, there's so many factors that play in. So I think we visit a lot of those things. We gather a lot of information. But I think it's kind of understood we're going to have to kind of tweak that to fit what's going to work here in our community. For these youth, the geography of even just getting them there. How do you put these groups together? You know, there's closed groups, there's open groups, there's certain age, there's some areas that don't really look at a 13-year-old and a 17-year-old that differently. We look at them pretty differently. We really don't want to put them in the same group. There's some states that don't see a need to separate groups by gender. And we do a lot of that here. We're going to have a girls group and a boys group, because the discussions that are going to go on in a group setting are going to be very different if they're both together versus if they're both separate. So there's definitely, you know, we have a lot of our executives attend those conferences and gather a lot of information on those programs. And then we adopt pieces of them. We'll adopt certain programming, but an overall program change or a new program coming would typically be something that we would change to fit the needs of this community.
So what's the first step in trying to make sure that you divert kids from custody? I mean, it's a big difference between, as you said before, between custody and probation. So, and it's a big step to order that. So is it you know the stick and the carrot? I mean, how do you, what are the techniques you use to make sure these kids understand that if you do this, you're going to be okay. If you don't do this, you're not going to be okay.
Well, so the first part of that was diversion. So there's a diversion factor that happens at times before it even comes to us. Law enforcement and the schools have an opportunity to divert them and not refer it to us at all for a very low level offense. So that's kind of the first step of not even bringing it to our attention. We recently got a grant called the Youth Reinvestment Grant that's going to be for several years, and it's going to provide them even more resources and evidence-based programming to divert those kids too, so that they never even cross our door. Once they come to us, there's certain offenses that are typically the violent serious offenses that we don't have discretion. Those need to be referred to the court. But most other offenses, we do have some discretion. And so we're going to often call them into the office, and we're going to get that whole picture of what's going on with that family. Sometimes you get that kid in there and it was a one-time mistake and the family is on top of it. This kid's in counseling. They're grounded. They've taken their phone away. They're doing community service. Like, this family's on top of it. There's nothing else that we're going to do that this family hasn't already done. And in a sense, just seeing us us has been their intervention. We're going to follow up and make sure everything's completed. Sometimes we're going to suggest that they go to a program, and we're going to offer them a couple different choices and programs that would seem to fit the need that they have. And then sometimes it's going to move toward probation. It just kind of depends on those circumstances.
So there was an article today in the New York Times about statistics that showed that immigrants don't cause more crime than anybody else. What do you see here? You know, this whole, you know, rhetoric among certain people that immigration is the cause of particularly, you know, low-level kinds of crime. Is that just a political falsehood?
You know, we're not looking at citizenship when we're doing an intake. We're looking at that's not something we consider at all. We're looking at, what is this offense? What is the harm caused? What are this child's needs? What are these families' needs? And how do we balance those and make both the community and this child and family whole again? We're not looking at their citizenship status.
And given the tight economic situations, is your budget ever threatened? I mean, given what you do, people could say, well, you know, this is really nice, but we have to make sure we have enough money for whatever. Is your budget ever in jeopardy?
Well, we're a county agency, so just like the other county agencies, we go before the Board of Supervisors every year to have our budget approved. And some of our money comes from the state and some of it comes from various grants. But just like any agency, that's reviewed every year to see if the level of funding should continue, increase, decrease. And if it's decreased, where should those cuts come from? But that's across the board for county agencies.
But has there been a problem with that? I mean, has money been an issue?
I mean, at different times, it's been an issue for this county. You know, when the recession hit, obviously, it was an issue for many of the agencies. Mm-hmm. We're very fortunate that we're able to staff to the level that we've requested and analyzed to be needed for several years now.
You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station. We'll be right back.
You're invited to dine indoors or on the secluded garden patio, the sunny patio, or the covered creekside patio with fireplace at Pierre Lafond's Montecito Wine Bistro, where you'll enjoy the popular pizzas and many other dishes from the wood-burning oven, daily specials from Chef Victor, and selections from the elevated wine menu featuring Lafond and Santa Barbara Winery wines. Open daily at 11 for lunch, wine, cocktails, dinner, incredible desserts, and a daily happy hour from 3 to 6 with very unique appetizers, in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
With some health providers, you get the impression that the final goal is profit. But Sansum Clinic is a nonprofit. Their final goal is health.
Sansum Clinic was started by doctors and is still directed by doctors dedicated to offering the very best in healthcare and healing for our patients.
A nonprofit organization where all earnings go back into continually improving healthcare for our community.
Your health.
Your doctors.
Your healthcare system.
Sansum Clinic. Good for you.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a four-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a four-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. Programs and workshops in classroom, online, with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online at csuci.edu.
The Central Coast may seem laid back, but when it's time to work, no one works harder, including the bank that's grown up here. Montecito Bank and Trust offers customized lending and banking for all businesses, big and small. It's harder than offering one-size-fits-all solutions, but it's the right thing to do. And here, getting things right is a way of life. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA helps teens achieve goals, surmount challenges, stop bullying, and communicate and listen effectively. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here with Erin Cross, a supervising probation officer in Santa Barbara County's Juvenile Services Division. You know, I just read this thing about stop bullying. Bullying is one of the most important things that I think a school can try to ameliorate, because it's horrible what they can do now cell phones, and not just physical bullying. Does that ever go to the level of a crime?
It does. I actually had a really interesting conversation. I was at a meeting, and someone from the school district was kind of put on the spot by some people at the meeting, and they were like, you really need to get to these kids and to these parents, and you need to talk about social media and bullying and all these things. And I think the schools do a really good job of trying to share that information and pass it along. And then the schools, of course, have their own frustrations because they try to have a symposium for parents to come to our meeting, and then the parents don't come, and, you know, the kids aren't listening or whatever it is, but the schools are trying. And it was kind of – I was trying to come to her defense, but I felt like she was kind of being bombarded with the schools need to do this. And at one point she said, the schools are doing the best we can, but at some point you guys keep asking us to teach this. When do we teach English and math? And as a parent, I was like, I'd actually kind of like you to teach English and math to my child. And so where is that responsibility to teach that bullying component? And it really should and start at home. You know, these kids are 10 years old walking around with a phone and they have Snapchat and Instagram. And I'm thinking, why? And it's one kid had it, and they said to the other, the kid says, well, so-and-so has it, and the parent just gives it to him. And we'll say to parents, are you checking their phone? Oh, no, they get mad. Well, what do you mean they get mad? Who pays for the phone? You pay for the phone. That's your phone. Check the phone. And I know I take my kids' phones and look at them all the time, and you're the mean mommy, but that's what needs to be done. And I think that's the piece that's missing, is you need to educate those parents that they're still the parent, and it's their responsibility to check the phone, to have those conversations about bullying, to be checking in with their kid, not just how was school, fine, and moving on from there. Who'd you sit with today? What did you talk about, kind of thing? And it does get on your kids' nerves, take my word for it. But I think it's important. We get the referrals when it's amounting to typically a threat or violence. That's when it would be referred to us.
But what you said is very important. That is, when you're treating somebody like in family therapy, you need the whole family. When you're treating a kid, and I'm using the word treating in a positive sense, you need the parents there. So when you have meetings with these kids, are the parents always required to be there?
We do our best to require the parents to be there. We have to keep in mind parents do have to work and they have to be able to support their family, and some of them really cannot get off work. We have situations where it's really not going to be productive to have everybody in the same room, and sometimes we have to meet with them separately before we can bring them together. And we do have some parents that just are not going to comply, and I've had parents walk in and say, I'm done. They're yours, and I have to explain it doesn't actually work that way. You can't just leave your child with me. I think that we do our best to engage them. It's hard when you get a 17-year-old kid and the parent probably hasn't been engaged for quite some time. I've sat down with parents and I've said, what do you mean you don't? They lock their door. It's your house. You know, what do you mean they don't let you in their cell phone? You pay the bill and they're still a minor living in your house. And parents are often frightened of their children, or they just want to avoid the whole situation. And so sometimes we really have to put some supports in place for those parents.
So speaking of supports, you have a whole bunch of programs here that typical of Santa Barbara are probably the fact that you have so many is just such a good thing. Substance abuse. You've got juvenile justice, crime prevention. You've got character development. What is El Joven Noble? What is character development?
El Joven Noble is a...
wait a minute. Did I pronounce it wrong?
Yeah.
Slightly.
But your assistant wasn't here to correct you, so I thought I'd throw it out there.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
So that's a program that guides the youth through rites of passage, and they're focusing on substance abuse, teen pregnancy, relationship violence, and school failure. They do it in a group setting, and they really kind of talk about some historical things, some cultural things, and they really open it up in that group setting. I mean, they have a curriculum they follow, but it's kind of an opportunity for these kids to talk about, you know, what is it about substance abuse, teen pregnancy, relationship violence, issues in school that they're struggling with, and kind of work together as a group towards solutions.
So is this group people on probation or everybody?
This is we use it as a probation-only group. We don't allow other kids into the group.
Okay, and what's gender-responsive reasoning and rehab mean?
So the gender-responsive part is it's either a girls' group or a boys' group. We don't mix the two, and that's one of our cognitive behavioral therapy programs, and it's really looking at the kids' criminogenic risk factors and the symptoms that are exhibited because of it, their likelihood to re-engage, and really kind of putting it out there and saying, okay, what are the triggers for you? What does it look like when you get impulsive? And really having those conversations of, could you do or put in that one more second to think before you do something, and how would it look different? And again, it's done in a group setting, so they're really kind of holding each other responsible in those conversations while separating by gender, so that it's not, you know, that girl-boy influence kind of isn't there, but they're doing things like, you know, helping develop social skills and critical thinking, really talking about valuing education. They have some focus on low self-esteem and low self-motivation and how to increase that.
And you also do mentoring. And, you know, mentoring, just to put a plug in for one of our sponsors, CSUCI, has a very robust mentoring program for incoming freshmen. So is mentoring from the professionals helping kids, or is it older kids who've been through the system mentoring these mentees, the new kids? Who's doing the mentoring?
No, well, so some families come to us with their own mentors. It's someone that the kid got connected to a long time ago, someone that's kind of that extended family. Some of them, and we just want to support that. We're not going to remove someone's support unless there's a very good reason to do that. The ones that we actually refer to are professional mentoring programs. And so those are adults. You run into some issues when we can't use children for confidentiality reasons and other things. But these are, you know, really adults that are educated in the system and the issues that these kids are facing. A lot of them have trauma-informed care training and crisis intervention training and really are trying to kind of just be that person they're talking to. But often that's somebody who's kind of getting the preliminary information and the picture of what's going on. And sometimes they're that conduit to referring to other services because that's the person they start confiding in, and they start kind of really finding out what the issues are.
So you have all these things which I believe cannot be universal across this country. Do you have statistics on recidivism rates that show that this stuff works? I mean, it seems to me it should work. Are there statistics that give some added comfort that what you do here actually makes a difference?
Well, there's certain evidence-based programs that we use that are cognitive behavioral therapy programs that they've done some research on, and the evidence does show that they reduce recidivism. There's only a couple of them that they even have looked at the numbers for juveniles. So we refer to those. We're utilizing those programs. We've only been using those for a couple of years. But as our risk assessment tool tells us, there's a lot of protective factors that these kids have that are really the things that are going to help reduce recidivism. And it's that trusted person in the community. It's getting them involved in sports. It's getting them involved in an internship program or an entrepreneurship program. It's different for every kid, but those things are not evidence-based, but they work.
So speaking of mentors, do your offices ever get so tied into a case where they really care about the kid that they become the mentor?
That's not really appropriate for what our role is. We certainly do our best to be there to support them. But really, given our role, that law enforcement social worker, that's not an appropriate role. We mentor unofficially, though, I think, in what we're doing. And a lot of these kids want to be held accountable. We do a lot of incentive-based things with them. You know, kids that weren't going to school at all, you went to school, you earned a credit, we're going to give you, you know, an ice cream, a gift card for some place. We really work on that. And in a lot of ways, that is mentoring, but we don't do it in official capacity. We look for someone else to do it.
So you don't give your cell phone number out?
No.
Okay. I've been watching too many TV shows.
I think so.
So you got a block grant, Useful Offender Block Grant. What's that?
We've actually had that for quite some time, and it's a grant that provides some programming and some of our funding for our officers to work with our kids that are most at risk for long-term detention. And we're working to reduce their recidivism through lowering those caseload numbers and having those probation officers be available to do some more intense work with them, but also through funding some of these programs.
Do you raise money from the public?
No, we do a biannual fundraiser for our Los Prietos Boys Camp and our juvenile probation, but it's a one-time every other year thing.
And the Boys Camp, you mentioned the Boys Camp is where you started. Is the Boys Camp a intervention program, or is it sort of like if I put this child in the camp, it may help that person keep out of trouble? How do you get into the camp?
Well, you're court ordered into the camp for 120 days or 180 days. It's only for boys, and they've had to have committed a violent, serious crime typically to get ordered there. And it's really a very comprehensive program. There's a school up there, and it's only for those boys that are up there. We have a lot of these cognitive behavioral therapy programs there. We have behavioral wellness counselors on site there. We have a culinary arts program that's also a regional occupational program. We have an auto body regional occupational program. So they're getting school and work
credits. So it's not
basically
a juvenile hall kind of thing.
No, it's an open setting in the forest.
You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB. We'll be right back with our final segment.
In 1962, Pierre Lafond founded the first post-prohibition commercial winery in Santa Barbara County. In 1972, he planted his first vineyard in the San Ynez Valley west of Buellton and later hired legendary winemaker Bruce McGuire to continue to build on the stellar reputation that Santa Barbara Winery has achieved for more than 50 years. Today, you're invited to experience the award-winning wines at Santa Barbara Winery at the corner of Yananali and Anacapa and the Lafond Winery at 6855 Santa Rosa Road in Buellton.
Sansom Clinic. We're there at the beginning.
And all the little and big steps along the way.
200 physicians for your every need.
A healthcare system where all profits go back into our community's health.
Your health.
Your doctors.
Your healthcare system. Your health.
Your doctors.
Your healthcare system.
Sansom Clinic. Good for you.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a four-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a four-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. CSU Channel Islands is affordable and financial aid is available with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online at csuci.edu.
What's that?
This? The newest online business banking around.
Can you initiate wires and approve transfers?
Yes.
Pay bills?
Check.
Cash management?
Of course.
All business, all online, all on your phone.
You bet. My computer, too. It's Montecito Bank and Trust's new business online banking. It works as hard as I do.
Huh. Montecito Bank and Trust.
You got it. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA helps teens manage their emotions, support their peers, and serve their community. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with Erin Cross, a supervising probation officer in Santa Barbara County's Juvenile Services Division. So, we've been talking about kind of really good things and optimistic things, which is, I guess, the goal. But what happens when, and how does it happen that you have to send a kid to juvenile hall? I mean, is that like the last resort?
We really try not to incarcerate kids, but there are kids who commit violent, serious crimes, and they've hurt somebody, and they need to be detained, and we put them in juvenile hall to keep them safe and to keep the community safe.
And I guess it's at some point you see them again. Because
yes.
I don't think juvenile jail is exactly the place to help them.
We actually have quite a few services in there, and we have kids who will tell us that they kind of needed that time out, and that's what they needed. You know, they needed that time out from everything that was going on in their life, and there actually are quite a few services in there.
So if a parent is concerned about the behavior of their child, not knowing anything about other sources, if just listening to the show, I'd want to call you. But I guess you're not the right, your department's not the right department. If you really are struggling with a child, you go to one of the mental health places or the school. You're not a direct line to helping parents with troubled kids.
No, I think there's a lot of stops before it should come to probation's attention. I know the YouthWell Coalition put together that two-sided sheet that all the schools have. I think they've all laminated them. And it's really a good picture of Santa Barbara. We're so fortunate. And it's mental health resources and counseling and, you know, there's domestic violence. There's relationship things. It's a huge resource for families. And I know I was recently at one of the schools, and that's kind of their first line is they hand this form out and try to empower the parents and say, here's 25 different resources that you can call. Many of them overlap in the services, so you can kind of shop around and see what's going to be the best fit. And quite a few of those have no cost.
So without mentioning names, do you have a favorite success story?
But if they're listening, then they would know who they are.
That's good. Okay. You don't know names.
I have several favorite success stories. And actually, I mentioned that Reimagining Juvenile Justice training I'm a part of, the grant. And we have a training coming up on the 9th. And three of my girls that I worked with are actually going to be speaking to this group about the system and what worked and what didn't work and what agencies were involved. And I'm so fortunate. Actually, right before I was walking out the door, another one of my girls was calling me. And these girls, I know it makes me older than I look. But they're all in their early to mid-30s, and they, you know, had every issue that you could imagine. You know, there was self-harm. They were one was born drug addicted, a lot of mental health issues, domestic violence in the home. One had a mother in prison. All of these girls had just every risk factor you can imagine. One of them had several teen pregnancies, and they've all come out on the other side. They're mothers now. All of them are mothers now. None of their kids are in the system. They have worked so hard to better themselves. They've all gotten at least some of their education. They're all working. And they all really feel like something made a difference to them that made it, it had them in the system. But now they're such better parents and better people because of the things that they learned. And so I've asked them, well, what was it? And it's very interesting because nobody pointed to a program. Everybody said it was the people. And it was people genuinely caring and taking the time to talk to him. And didn't sink in then, but it sunk in later. And several of these girls that I've kept in touch, they've kept in touch with me over all these years, actually mentioned that it was a staff at Juvenile Hall that made a difference.
Well, after listening to you for an hour, Erin, I believe that you're terrific. You've got more credentials than most people in therapy with a therapy license, and we're lucky to have you and your department. Thank you for being here, and thank you all for listening to AHA Presents About Education, and we'll see you next week.
It's